The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
A warm welcome to everyone on the line for this session with Chris Bloomstrand. Chris is the President and Chief Investment Officer of Semper Augustus Investments Group, which he founded in 1998. Chris has more than 25 years of investment experience with a value-driven approach to fundamental equity and industry research. I've had the pleasure of meeting Chris in person at the Zurich Project, and he has also been an instructor at our online conferences, and I've greatly appreciated Chris's ideas and wisdom. Chris, it's really a pleasure to have you here to provide your perspective on what's quite a unique moment in market history. So I'd like to turn it to you to kind of set the stage in terms of how you assess this situation and what you've been up to.
Well, thanks, John. It's good to be with you. I sure hope that as we get toward June, that maybe we'll see you in Zurich again. I'm sure here in the interim you've been, and your family has been as disrupted as everybody. I'm sure your kids are not playing soccer. You know, my daughter, a freshman in college on the West Coast in LA, lost her freshman season, golf season. But beyond that, I mean, everybody's suffering a little bit, but my heart and our heart here really goes out to anybody that's been, you know, truly impacted health-wise by this thing. But with that, I'll jump in. I don't even know how to answer the question. I mean, this is truly one of the most unprecedented things we've ever seen. I've not seen it in my investing lifetime. You know, I've spent a lot of time over the years studying financial history, and you can't find an episode where there are parallels. The sudden decline, the notion that entire industries are shut down flat on their back, has never been seen. We go back to the Great Depression, you know, the period leading up and the decline from 1929 to 1932, 33 at the trough. I think nominal GDP was $103 billion in 1929, and it fell to, I think, $54, $55 billion, so almost by half. But it took 3-4 years to get there. Unemployment went from 3% or so. You know, everybody knows the headline number, 24.9%. If you exclude the agrarian community, unemployment got up to 38, 39, 40%. But again, it took 3 years to get there. And if you think about that period, consumption went in very similar to where it is now. Consumption as a percentage of GDP at about 70%. And it's interesting that during that decline, consumption grew to more than 90% of GDP. So you cut the economy in half. The people still have to eat, you know, they still have to drink. And so there's a layer of the economy that still exists. I think, you know, here we are not knowing how deeply the economy is going to be impacted and for what duration. You know, we know, and we're doing a ton of work here, you know, trying to get our mind around the industries that surround the businesses that we own and how deep this thing winds up being. And then we've got to assess how we're going to be impacted by all this federal programs between the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department, both here and what's going on with central banking and governments more broadly. But it's just an unknowable thing. My instinct is that going into this, we started with a whole different set of parameters than you had going into the Depression or than you had going into World War II. Even in some ways more extreme than we had going into the 2000-02 downturn and 2008-09. I mean, we've got on balance sheet debt levels that are 350% of GDP, and that's on balance sheet here domestically. You know, abroad, numbers look very similar. You throw in off balance sheet liabilities for Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and we just have an enormous amount of on balance sheet and off balance sheet debt burden to contend with. And in a decline, these debt numbers are knowable. You know, we're going to find out very quickly, and we're finding out now what it means to have fixed cost in your capital structure and what it means to have variable cost in your capital structure. But, you know, you take the Great Depression, and everybody knows the very long-term chart that shows a giant spike in debt. And I think the general presumption is that during the roaring 20s, that debt rose commensurately. You know, we all hear that there was an enormous amount of margin debt at that period. Well, in fact, yeah, there was some margin debt, but the stock market, you know, was not the overriding asset class in the economy. Debt levels went into the downturn, I'm going to say, you know, out of memory, at, you know, about 100% of GDP. So as I said, if GDP was $103 billion, call total credit market debt $100 billion. And everybody has seen that spike up to 200 or thereabouts percent. But, you know, when you think about it, and I've written about this in my letters, it was the decline of half in GDP that sent the debt level from 100% to 200%. And in fact, during those 3 or 4 years of decline and then the elongation of the L-shaped downturn that was the Great Depression, you actually paid down debt. You know, I think debt levels would have gone from, you know, somewhere on the order of $100 billion to $80 billion. And so you got up to 180 or 190% of GDP. But we didn't start at 350%. There's very little room for error here. And I think that's why you're seeing the scope of this now second huge bailout by the government. You know, not unlike what we did in 2008, but, you know, we never really cleaned up the structure. You know, we went into that downturn with debt levels at 350% of GDP. In 1999, 2000, they were 250% of GDP, and we struggled with those numbers. But, you know, as you know, we built up real estate and we added the debt following the 2002 recession. And you wound up at 350. Well, here we are still at 350%, and we haven't cleaned it up. I mean, the Fed's balance sheet was $850 billion or so in 2007, and we ran it up to as high as $4.5 trillion. And then following the last iteration of QE, you know, we tapered. The government allowed various of its bonds and mortgages to roll off. And I think the Fed's balance sheet got down to about $3.7 trillion at the end of last year. And then we had the crisis in the repo market, which was really the canary in the coal mine, liquidity disappearing despite what seems to be a better capitalized banking system. You know, certainly here, I don't know as much about, you know, Germany with the German banks and some of the European banks that still have, you know, huge amounts of assets and very little equity capital sitting under them. But we were seemingly better capitalized, but there's no liquidity. And so the Fed, you know, ramped up what they said was not QE, but took the balance sheet back up to, I guess, 4.1, 4.2 trillion. Just last week, now that we are back in the QE game, we were back up to 4.5 trillion. I think as of this week, we're 4.7. And then you get then you get the announcement that we're going to have unlimited QE. And I saw a release this morning by the Treasury effectively saying they're going to recapitalize or add capital to the Fed to the tune of about 10% or so of its current amount of Fed credit. So if you were $4.5 trillion going in, I think the number was $450 billion, which can effectively be geared up and levered up on a 10-to-1 basis, which means we're going to create $4 trillion worth of capital support really out of thin air. And you apply it to the overall, you know, economic picture. You know, we were already in bad shape. You know, we were going to go into this year with an expectation of running a budget deficit of about $1 trillion. So call it 5% of GDP. GDP was going to be $22 billion. Well, it's not going to be $22 billion now. You know, you've got estimates all over the map from James Bullard, the president of the St. Louis Fed here, with really onerous predictions for how badly, at least for 3 or 4 months, GDP would be impacted, and then for the duration of the year. You've got some of the Wall Street houses that are looking for 1% and 2% declines. Well, I mean, if you just assume we drop, you know, from 22 to 21, you know, call it a 5% decline, which I think is going to wind up being modest. At the margin, given what was already a $1 trillion deficit, the deficit is just going to balloon. If, you know, if we run 5% and receipts are, let's say, you know, at a 5% differential, 17% or so, which is tax revenues coming in, you've got outlays of 5% more than that, so call it 22%. Well, those numbers are going to blow out on either side. I mean, if on a 20 trillion, just for math's sake, just on 20 trillion, call it $4 trillion in receipts and $5 trillion in outlays, money going out the door. I mean, I think you can make a case that receipts are going to be down by 25% from $4 to $3 trillion. Outlays, we know they're going to go up from $5 trillion at least a $7 trillion. So you're now looking, instead of a $1 trillion deficit, probably four, which is unheard of in peacetime. Debt levels, the cumulative effect of all of these ongoing deficits becomes your federal debt, which it was already in excess of GDP by a bit, maybe 105, 110%. If you run those numbers and we take debt from $23.5 trillion up to $27 to $28 trillion, you're looking at debt now, just federal debt to GDP of 130%. You're getting into, where you start to have danger zones. So it's unprecedented. And, we sit here as capital allocators and investors in common stocks, and I find us doing stress testing on a credit basis companies that have net cash in their capital structure or that don't employ on balance sheet debt. You've got retailers that have operating leases and what have you, but we spend a lot of time in the footnotes of the companies that we own trying to figure out how durable these businesses are. And I think you'd be hard pressed to find many other investors that run cleaner balance sheets than we have. We went into the year with businesses earning 13 on equity and 12 on capital, which means we've got about 10% net debt in the capital structure of our aggregate businesses. More than half of our businesses have net cash. And so, our businesses roughly earn on capital what they earn on equity, which you just don't find, given that the typical business across the major indices and across the major stock markets use half debt and half cash, or half debt and half equity in the capital structure. And so, we think we've got wiggle room and margin for error, but we find ourselves assessing how much cash we have, how much access our businesses have to lines of credit, and then you're looking at how quickly you can cut expenditures and where you do have fixed costs and where you have variable costs. How quickly can you defer or slow down CapEx and R&D? What about your labor? Are you going to keep people on, or are you going to fire employees? There's just a whole lot of moving parts to assess. And they're genuinely businesses that are perceivingly in good shape, that if you have 2 or 3 or 4 months of protracted downturn, you've really got problems. And so I think that's where you introduce this federal money. And the notion is, well, nobody could have predicted this. And you can't blame businesses for a complete stoppage in the economy. And so first and foremost, to figure out who's essential. Well, I think it was clear at the outset that if we're going to confine people to their homes for a period of weeks or for a period of months, you've got to have access to medicine. You've got to have access to food. So I think the first thing that was done was to ensure access to the food supply in our system, the grocery stores. We own Dollar General, which I talked about on your platform in January, I think a couple of years ago. So we're in good shape with some of those. But, you've got industries that without access to capital just can't cut it. And to the degree you've got more leverage employed in the capital structure, it makes that margin for error ever much more thin. So it's interesting. I find myself on the phone with everybody. We've talked, I can't tell you how many CEOs, CFOs, investor relations folks that are kind of in our network, hospital directors and CEOs of hospital systems trying to get the lay of the land for how long these things are going to run. Executives within big pharma businesses, we're trying to assess where plants are still running and where they're down. We talked to one generic / branded pharma CEO the other day, and you've got 60 plants in this business system. They're all running, and I think people have taken great steps to ensure we have supply of medicine. So you take the typical factory that produces pharmaceuticals, you may have 20 or 30 different lines of production, or you may have 100 different lines of production. Well, they have to take great steps in this environment to segregate all of those lines, because you've got to have all of your shifts running. And so you'll completely isolate a line. So if somebody is infected with this virus in one case, you can cordon off a finite portion of a manufacturing facility, but not take the entire plant down. It's interesting. I think what we're doing, the human response to this thing is terrific. Reminds me of Amity Schley's book, The Forgotten Man, and how we dealt with the Great Depression. And then, moving on, getting into World War II, we took basically the whole industrial manufacturing capacity of our economy and converted it to the war effort. I think business leaders in our country got ahead of the White House. They got ahead of the Roosevelt administration, and they geared up our manufacturing capacity. And instead of making cars, we started making planes, and we made ships, and we made tanks. And certainly we were supporting the war in Europe, but I think there was a sense that we'd be pulled into that fight. But again, in contrast to what we're seeing today, that was done on a for-profit basis, and it kept the populace employed. You saw the headline unemployment numbers this morning, 3+ million unemployed. Well, that's just really the first week of this downturn. That number, if the word that we're getting from our folks and our contacts in the health world suggests that, you know, I think the White House, I applaud them for being optimistic. I think the commander-in-chief has to be the chief cheerleader at this point and trying to keep people's spirits up. But the sense we're getting is that if we're 2 weeks, let's say, behind Italy and behind Spain and behind Germany in the duration of this virus, then, you know, we're a week and a half from seeing it peak. But there's no sense that you can flip the switch and put everybody back to work immediately. I mean, it's going to be, in all likelihood, a couple months. So again, businesses without revenues for 2 months, go through the cost structure and figure out what you've got on your hands. You know, it's you know, requiring every ounce of analytical, you know, ability that we have to ensure that we've got businesses that have staying power, not just for this period, but beyond. So I'll stop there and take questions. I could just ramble on. I've been on the phone so much in the last 2 weeks, I'm starting to lose my voice. But anything else you'd like to talk about, John?
Yeah, thank you so much. That's extremely helpful. Actually, before we get into questions on what you just said, I'd actually love to take a step back. You wrote a terrific annual letter that you sent out, I think, on February the 14th, and you titled it Money for Nothing. There's some great things in there that, you know, where you expressed some sentiments that were clearly non-consensus. I'm wondering if you could just kind of tell us a little bit about that, because it's important to understand the context with which you kind of went into the crisis that I think nobody saw in early February.
Well, so you're very kind. I've actually got a couple people that have been trying to convince me that my letter's too short, but they're in the vast minority. And I do promise that next year's letter is going to be materially shorter than that of this year. But I've got certain themes. You know, for the last couple, 3 years, you know, we've believed that overall equity market valuations are very, very high. You know, by some yardsticks and fundamental measures, we're more expensive now than we were in 2000. Or the late 1960s or the late 1920s. By others, were not as expensive. You know, I've always tried to get a sense for what I thought fair value for the S&P 500 was. You know, we are of the mind, we went into the year believing that earnings expectations out of Wall Street, both top down and bottom up, were too high, but that's generally the case. You know, I wrote this year and even last year that we thought that the third quarter of 2018, which saw profit margins north of 12%, I want to say they were 12.12 or 12.13%, that those would be kind of that quarter would mark kind of your peak margin for a very long period of time. You know, that was kind of where you had the peak benefit, maximum benefit from the tax code changes at the end of 2017. I think we went out last year with the S&P at 157 in earnings. And so on an operating basis, when you back off write-offs and write-downs, I think you were 139 or 140. So, you know, depending on how you cut it, trading, you know, for somewhere between 21 and 23 times. Looking forward, I think estimates were as high as 180, 175, which we thought was crazy. The economy was already slowing. And a lot of industries were slowing. I looked on S&P's website the other day, and I think they've got the number down to 165 in operating earnings for the year, which is just insane. Again, you're going to have very little growth, and a lot of companies with massive operating losses before you get into writing down assets and writing down goodwill and intangibles. You know, $140 in top line operating earnings has kind of been our working assumption for the year. And, you know, we simply, you know, jumped to a 15 multiple. So we've kind of had in the back of our minds an optimistic case that the S&P was fairly valued at 2,100. Well, we almost got there a couple of days ago. You know, we're well above it at 2,600 or even more. I saw a big spike here in the last 30 minutes, so I don't know exactly where we closed. But against that $140 number, I'm shaving $30 per year off for just the accounting nonsense that we've written about. I think 2 years ago, I spent a lot more time in the letter. So, you know, we're starting off with a period where stocks were already too expensive. And if we're going to go through a deleveraging phase and we're going to take unemployment back up from the mid threes where it's been to a more normalized letter, you're going to get some kind of recovery. I don't think we're going to get a V-shaped recovery, but you might get a U or somewhat of a cross between an L and a U. We're still far from what I would call sensible valuations. And that's even in a world of no interest rates. You know, if you go back to the Depression, getting up to the World War II period, you know, we kept short-term rates at zero. And I was on the phone with a property casualty insurance company CEO the other day, and he reminded me of the period after the war, which I think was called the Fed Treasury Accord, where we intentionally bought long bonds to suppress the long end of the curve. Well, that's very much on the table today. So, you know, I start the letter every year with that macro theme, and I've tried to say for the last 2 or 3 years that the stock market's been very expensive and credit has been excessive. And so for that and for that sense, we've taken within our firm, within Semper, investment-wise, we've kind of pivoted the other way. And we've, as credit extended and as valuations expanded, you know, we took business quality the other direction. And, you know, to date, the sell-off, as everybody knows, has been pretty indiscriminatory. And this bounce here in the last couple of days, once everybody's starting to get their mind around what this congressional package is going to wind up looking like, and just the massive amount of capital and support that we're going to throw underneath the credit markets, it's hard to get your mind around. So, you know, we've been cautious, and it's frustrating in a lot of levels. So, you know, if you look at some of the businesses that have recovered the most in the last couple of days, in a lot of cases, it's those that have employed the leverage structures within their capital that we avoid, that we go out of our way to avoid. And, you know, I think businesses, if we're going to gin up a lot of money, and let's be real about what we call this thing. I mean, we're monetizing debt now in a big way. We've been doing it, but we're very much monetizing it in a big way. You know, I feel like we've been fools at some level for owning businesses. And I feel like the folks that run the businesses that we own are fools for not employing more leverage in the capital structure, because the winners when you monetize debt are those that have the largest amounts of leverage. As long as you don't get restructured and have your equity capital entirely wiped out, you survive and you party on. And it's a frustrating thing, but I think it's plausible, even without this virus, that we were in the early innings of a downturn anyway. So, you know, I'll take our portfolio and some of the modifications that we've made and, you know, move forward and think we're in pretty good shape. You know, we're down kind of in line with the S&P. And, you know, we've got a lot of smaller mid-cap names in the portfolio. We're about a third, maybe 30% international businesses, and those outside of the S&P and out of the NASDAQ 100 got beat up pretty hard. I think at the lows, small and mid-caps were down mid-40s. I think the S&P was down 32, 33. We got down to about 29, 30, 31 at a point, and we find ourselves down now kind of in the high teens, maybe 20%. And so not so bad, but I'm not sure we're all the way through this thing. You asked about the letter and the money for nothing, the knock on dire straits. Really, I really wanted to talk about stock options. You know, spent a lot of time in the section. You know, we've thought a lot about the issue and written a lot about the issue over the years. And I think it's kind of a one-sided. I think the public take and the media take on stock options is one-sided, or on share repurchases rather. And, you know, I think the media and politicians deem them abusive. And obviously, throughout time, there are great cases where, and we own a lot of businesses that are only buying shares back when they're undervalued. I think Berkshire Hathaway does a great job with that. We own Subsea 7. They're buying back stock. There are a lot of companies that are cheap, but then you've got those that simply repurchase shares as the mantra of returning capital to shareholders. And they make no distinction between a share repurchase or a dividend. Well, that's entirely wrongheaded, as your whole community knows. Share repurchase makes sense if you're buying shares for less than intrinsic value. And if you're overpaying for economic earning power, then you're throwing capital out the door. And so what I wanted to look at was the degree to which companies were consuming profit and capital to offset the dilution that comes from the front end, which nobody gets exercised about, but that's really the problem. It's the degree to which once we did away, or once we introduced expensing of stock options, that companies have increasingly resorted to restricted shares, which are just an outright grant, which wind up being far more expensive and dilutive because they don't come with capital in. You know, if you take a stock at $50 a share and you issue a stock option to an employee with, you know, say a 5 or 10 year vesting schedule, well, the employee only makes money if the stock rises north of 50. And regardless whether they're incentive stock options or non-qualified options, you have to come up with the cash, and it can be done on a cashless basis, but you have to pay for those shares at the $50 strike. So if the stock rises to 90, you know, the employee's got a $40 gain, but the company does get paid for the 50. When you issue restricted shares, whether they're performance shares or just straight RSUs, at $50 a share, those will come with a vesting schedule. In some cases, in lesser cases, they'll come with various performance metrics, but generally they're just outright grants that are only subjected to a vesting schedule. And so, you know, early on when we made the pivot from stock options to RSUs, to restricted shares, the amount of shares given away per year, the percentage of shares outstanding that were granted to executives and employees, dropped. And in the last decade, post the financial crisis, it's been on the rise. And so what you've got now is an inordinate proportion of restricted shares outstanding versus stock options that are owned by the employee with no cash coming in. And so what's really important is not just repurchases, but net repurchases. So early on, offset by the income coming in, offset by the cash going out to repurchase. And so we ran the math, and it was a Herculean project in that, you know, we did not have an S&P does not provide great data. So we had to reconstruct the financial statements and the cash flow statements for the entire S&P 500 back to the 1980s. Mammoth data pull. But what I wanted to get a sense of was, from the cash flow statement, cash in for equity sales and then cash out for share repurchases. And what we found was, over a long period of time, you're getting about 3% of market value per year expended on share repurchases. And despite a rising stock market for the last decade, that proportion stayed very high. So we were spending 3% of the company, which in the last 5 or 6 years, between dividends and repurchases, amounted to more than 100% of profit. So to the extent the repurchases were more than 100% of profit, companies were taking on leverage, putting debt on the balance sheet to buy back stock. Well, if there was 3% going out, you had about 1% coming in, is all, from those shares that are bought on option programs. So the net dilution to shareholders is about 2% a year. And you take the divisor for the big indices, you take the divisor for the S&P 500, and it's declined by 1%. So you've got 3% going out to buy back shares, yet your share count is only, or your shares outstanding, your share count is declining by 1%. Where's the delta? Well, that's the dilution that's very real. And if you take the last decade, and I think people would find it hard to believe, but when I looked at the Fab Five, the big five tech stocks, and compared their mammoth growth in sales and profits and cash flows to the broad market, S&P 500 sales, line sales for our economy has been about 3.5% a year. So if you're growing the top line at 3.5%, you're diluting your shareholders by 2, there's nothing left. And so here we are with a whole bunch of businesses and a whole bunch of industries that are starved for capital, that are going to have to recapitalize in some way, shape, or form, whether it comes from the government, whether it comes from preferreds, from Berkshire Hathaway, we're going to have dilution going the other way. Not so much on share issuance, but we're going to be issuing capital because you have to issue it. And as you know, if companies were buying back stock to offset the dilution from share issuance,
those repurchases were done on average at multiples to earnings of north of 20 times, so at earnings yields of less than 5%. And just like in 08-09, when repurchases stopped and went to nothing, the banking industry and other industries had to raise capital. So they were raising it at the most expensive terms. So it's very much not the buy low, sell high. It's very much the buy high, sell low. And it's a criminal thing. And so if we're going to bring all of this new liquidity to the party, I think it's proper to say you're not going to buy back more stock. But they really ought to say you're not going to issue any more stock. I mean, I'd go as far as to say there ought to be a penalty. If you're running a business and you have to take federal capital to stay alive, then if you've gotten filthy rich by being issued shares and having sold those shares, not kept them. I mean, to me, there ought to be a provision when a company issues either a stock option or an RSU that you keep those shares for the duration of your employment. And there probably ought to be a sunsetting where you've got to keep your shares for some period of time after you retire, you know, with exclusions for being fired or what have you. But, you know, if you've gotten rich, you ought to pay the price when you have to recapitalize your business. And unfortunately, that's not the way this works. So, you know, it's a lot on that theme, but it's going to be a big theme here in the next few months and for the duration of the year when we wind up recapitalizing a lot of businesses. And I'm not sure the folks in Washington have the sense to think through the issues properly.
Yeah, thanks.
Again, I'll stop there. I could go on and talk till I'm blue in the face about the issue. It's bothered me to no end, and you know, the behavior that you're seeing now and the handouts are just going to be grotesque in size and proportion.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris, just to talk a little bit about opportunities that might be out there. You mentioned Dollar General. It's an idea you've presented in the past. Another company you've shared with us in the past is Cummins, the diesel engine maker. Would you care to talk a little bit about where you're looking right now, where you're seeing some interesting dislocations, either in terms of sector or specific businesses?
Sure. I mean, I can talk about those two specifically for a quick second, and also just more broadly in the portfolio. Again,
sure.
You know, we've stress tested, and I've got two businesses. You know, one that I bought very recently, which I'm going to chalk up to what you know, if you don't have enough access to capital, it'll wind up being a mistake. And I've never bought a business and turned around and sold it within 3 months, but we might do it in this case. I've got another business in the portfolio that is just a mistake. And, you know, I had a friend of mine talk about, you know, whether you should have cash in the portfolio or not. And, you know, talking about, you know, systemically, you know, if we're going into anything other than a V-shaped meltdown or a V-shaped recovery, you know, if this thing is a durable decline in the economy with capital restructuring, then would it make sense to just ground the plane and raise a bunch of cash? And that gets into discussions about hyperinflation and what does cash do for you. But, you know, I again, through this stress test that we've gone through across all of the names in our portfolio, we've got about 30 stocks in the portfolio, which is heavily weighted at the top end. Our top 10 account for about 75% of the capital. And we went into the year with our businesses trading at about 13 times, so, you know, 7.5% earnings yield on unlevered capital. And so, you know, we were at a 13 ROE and a 12 return on capital. So we have been very active to the extent we have various clients that have cash. And we do have a lot of clients that are, you know, we run all of their capital and we're in charge of the allocation. And they've had varying degrees of cash on the sidelines. We've been very active buyers during the downturn. We've put a lot of that cash on the sidelines. We have some very great new clients that have come on board here in the last few months. Some very substantial clients for us, which is great. It turns out there's a lot of cash sitting on the sidelines that's been watching, I think, some folks that, you know, perhaps do this thing as right as you can. And kind of surprisingly, you know, we're finding some great new clients that I think will be clients for decades. And so we have cash to spend. So within the portfolio, we've bought a lot. We actually trimmed Dollar General a couple of weeks ago to raise cash to buy other things that were more opportunistic. So, you know, we had Dollar General that we bought, oh, I'm going to guess back in 2016, maybe the early 2017, at, you know, kind of high 50s, low 60s per share, and had made, in my opinion, too much money too soon. You know, the stock is a couple of weeks ago trading at 160 plus, which I think was, you know, pretty close to fully valued. But, you know, it's a business that I alluded to, you know, determining who's essential during this downturn. Well, the food supply nationally and globally is essential, and Dollar General is on the front line of that. And we determined there's no way, no way would Dollar General close. You know, 70% of their 70% of their stores, and they've got about 16,000 stores nationwide, 70% are in rural areas. And so, you know, Costco has seen just a huge increase in same store sales. Ditto for Dollar General, Walmart, you know, the essentials, the grocery stores. You saw Kroger. I mean, Berkshire Hathaway announced they had bought a little bit of Kroger in the stock portfolio this year. You know, those places are essential. So Dollar General, we look at it, and, you know, I took half the position. It was 4%. I took half off to buy Disney at prices that made no sense. I made a huge portfolio management error a couple of years ago when we bought Disney for the first time at an average of $99 a share, only to watch the merger with Fox Media's assets close, to watch the rollout of Disney Plus, which people realized, well, Disney is worth a heck of a lot. You know, we had it earning $7.50 a share going into the year. You know, with very high opportunities to invest incremental capital. The business itself earns high returns on capital. And I made the portfolio management error of making it too small of a position. I had 1% in, and it ran it up from 99 to, I think, 148 or 150 bucks. But, you know, great, you make 50% with 1%. Well, you know, for this crisis, the stock just got pummeled. I mean, and everybody knows that Disney has, you know, material investments in theme parks and even a cruise line. Well, the theme parks and the cruise line are a third of their business, and they're closed. Shanghai closed first. Hong Kong closed. Tokyo closed. We closed Disney World. We closed Disneyland. You know, the cruise operation is obviously not running. That's a third of companies' operating income. Big deal. Disney's not going to earn $7.50 this year, but we will recover. And again, if it's not a V, you know, I think you get to the point in terms of thinking about how you value businesses. And I think this is an important lesson, and I think your community will get it. I think a lot of you know, more amateur investors wouldn't. But if you go back to 2008, I'm going to go off on a tangent here, but if you go back to 2008 and 09, you know, we took earnings on a reported basis down to negative. I want to say, you know, earnings going into after 07 were supposed to be maybe, you know, 70 or 80 bucks for the S&P 500 off the top of my head. And I want to say operating earnings got down to, you know, still positive, but they weren't much. Well, you know, but earnings had fallen, in the case of reported, to an impossible number because there were losses for a quarter or two. And so you had to look through, and you had to talk to your clients about, when, you know, when you're valuing a business, you're valuing all of the future profit. So, you know, so what looked like these incredibly high PEs were only high PEs based on extremely depressed profitability. It wasn't like 1982 when you had profits that were washed out at a 3% profit margin and we were paying 7 or 8 times earnings. So, you know, 21% or 24% of sales at the lows in 1981, 82. I mean, there you had low margins and you had low multiples. Well, that wasn't so much the case. You had very high multiples in 08, but that's because earnings had been so crushed. So, you know, now you've got to think about capitalizing, you know, if you're capitalizing profits, not using what are going to wind up being this year's numbers, but you've got to start thinking about capitalizing 2021 and 2022. But you've also got to make the assessment of the degree to which profitability is permanently impaired. And I remember doing that back in 08 and going through the portfolio and running our intrinsic value models and trying to assess how long that economic downturn would last and whether there was any real diminution of profitability. Because you look foolish by saying, well, I've got businesses that are going to sail right through this thing. Well, I take a Dollar General, and guess what? Dollar General is going to sail right through this thing. All of their stores are running. They're hiring employees. They're running shifts in the morning to accommodate seniors. They were on the front end of that curve. And if you look at the business historically, Dollar General is a business that thrives during economic downturns. Their same store sales are always the highest in the teeth of a recession or depression. Why? Because their median household income of their customers is half of the national average, so call it $30,000. And what happens when you get into a recession and unemployment rises? Well, a lot more families become incumbent on the use of food stamps. And so food stamp use will be part of these provisions going forward. And I think it's, ironically, it's about as counter-cyclical of a business as you can get. So Dollar General sails right through it, and you can make a case for, everybody can make their own case for valuation. I still think it's holdable because I think a decade hence, they'll, instead of having 16,000 plus stores, they'll be running 24,000 stores. I think they've still got a long runway to grow. Cummins, on the other hand, was already in an economic downturn. We had run through some environmental standards that began in 2010 here domestically, and various other standards in Europe and in Asia. They've got joint venture partnerships in China and India. But Cummins was already in a downturn. Their customers were already taking fewer trucks. They'd already upgraded to meet environmental requirements. The company went into the downturn in very good shape, essentially a great balance sheet for what's a very capital intensive business. They had cash exceeding total debt on the balance sheet, but you stress test the thing and they've got, in addition to the $1.5 billion in cash, they've got almost $3 billion in revolver capacity. And so, but you got to look through to a business like this. So you look through to their big customers, Volvo, Navistar, Picard, Daimler. They're closed. They've closed their manufacturing facilities. So the large portion of Cummins business that sells diesel engines into these OEM customers has stopped for a period of time. And that's where you've got a stress test. Well, if that part of the business is closed, how durable is that piece of the business? The good news is Cummins has a huge installed base of distributors and service centers domestically and around the globe. And what's essential if we're going to keep the food supply up and running? Well, the trucking supply. And so the truckers are running. The truckers are going to run through the worst of this virus because we've got to feed the people. You don't want to get into a scenario, obviously. You can't even imagine a scenario where we don't have access to food. You can't even think about it. And so there's a portion of Cummins that will operate during a downturn, and the distributors and certainly the service centers are there to service trucks and provide parts that are needed. And so, but the stock was already cheap. I mean, our basis in the stock was in the low 140s. It traded to 100 last week, earlier this week. It's recovered a lot. I don't know where it's closed today, but 133. We had earnings going into the year for Cummins at about $12. They were $15 last year. I mean, there's a case that they could be 7 or 8, but again, you can't capitalize the downturn. You have to ask the question: can Cummins survive this economic downturn? And we're of the mind that their balance sheet is terrific and the management's terrific, and they'll scale this thing accordingly. And they may go through a period where a portion of the business is flat on its back and makes no money, but they have the liquidity and sources of liquidity to where they won't need a federal bailout to survive. And that's where a lot of our businesses are. So. I don't want to go through the whole portfolio and talk about what we're doing. There are places where we have more weaknesses, and there are places where we have just obvious apparent strengths. I would be happy if you wanted me to kind of scroll through some of the conversations that we've had and a lot of the work that we've done in the insurance world and talk about Berkshire. You think about property casualty insurance and reinsurance. And the first thing that jumps out at everybody is business interruption insurance. And so, we've done a whole bunch of work in the last couple of weeks trying to get our mind around what we knew to be the case. And that is, business interruption is a property line that generally almost always requires property damage. It's a property line. And so, the underwriters will tell you, and the lawyers that represent, we've talked to some lawyers that represent, some of the Lloyd syndicates, a lot of precedent in law that will be very important in terms of demonstrating that you've got to have true property damage. Now, the lawyers are going to come along, of course, because you've got a lot of business interruption, and they'll claim that the introduction of a virus into a restaurant or into a facility is a physical thing. And then you have the counter issue of, well, how long does it take to actually clean a virus and for a virus to die on its own? So we'll see it tested in the courts, but we think the property casualty insurers and reinsurance, when it comes to the business interruption lines that they write, have very good, I'm not going to call it ironclad precedential law in their hip pocket, but we're in pretty good shape there. You know, the other biggie, and it's written, I think, more in Europe than it is here domestically, would be cancellation policies. So you think about every professional sports league that's down, you think about television rights, you think about the Olympics now being punted for a year. My understanding and what we've heard is those lines are typically in good shape because the industry learned its lesson after SARS and typically requires a separate rider for pandemics that very few buy. And so, you know, we think somewhere between 5%, 10%, maybe no more than 15% of cancellation policies have those riders in place. And without the explicit rider, you don't have a claim. Counterintuitively as well, and we've got other businesses in the portfolio that benefit as well. But you think about GEICO inside of Berkshire, also on the insurance front, they're a huge beneficiary of an economic downturn of this magnitude, because where do losses evolve when you're writing personal auto or commercial auto policies? Well, from auto accidents. And if nobody's driving, think about the degree to which frequencies of accidents will go down. And so the loss ratios for the first quarter and the second quarter are going to be unbelievably high and profitable. Now, the regulators will come back and take that away from them. But you'll also have the case to be made that we're going to normalize the underwriting cycle. And once people are back to work, that the frequencies will snap back up. But you're going to show at least, top line underwriting profits. The struggle that more insurers are going to have is, we're back to the zero interest rate world. I can make the case that we'll have, barring hyperinflation, short-term rates at zero for another decade, maybe negative. And you look at the three-month bill here in the last couple of days, it's negative. You've got negative interest rates all over the globe in terms of sovereign debt. And so the insurance companies that depend to a large extent for investment of their investment assets in fixed income, which is not the case in Berkshire, but it is in most cases, 90% on average invested in bonds, you're now faced with much, much lower interest rate environment that we had, at least for a respite for a couple, 3-year period of time. So insurance-wise, we think Berkshire is in very good shape. You think about the other sides of the business, the railroad is going to be off. The level of rail traffic is down. When I flew to LA a couple weekends ago to drive home for the rest of the school year with my daughter and bring her Jeep back, we were just stunned at the number of trains that were parked on side tracks already. You saw that in 2008-09. When the economy stopped. I remember flying around the country. Obviously, the whole economy wasn't idle. And when I flew around to visit managements and companies and see clients during that period, it was stunning when you fly into a port city and see, containers stacked on top of each other for as far as the eye could see, or in the rail yards in Chicago. Well, you're getting that now again, and rail traffic will be down. But the good news with Burlington is a lot of their costs are variable. You think about if the number of car loads is down and the number of trains running is down, well, you're not spending as much on fuel. And so that's down. So there are clearly fixed costs, but if Burlington was going to do $5 or $6 billion in profits this year, you could shave a little bit, but as economic activity picks back up, they'll be fine. But Burlington's not a case where profits go to zero. There's enough variable cost in the cost structure there to keep them out of trouble. Ditto would be the case for electric utilities, for the four utilities and the transmission and energy assets that the business has. If they were going to do $3 or $4 billion, you make the case that energy use for the duration of this downturn, when people are quarantined to their homes and plants in a lot of cases are not running, we're going to use a hell of a lot less energy. But this is a regulated business. There's a lot of variable costs there. The fuel supply that goes to power plants, declines commensurate with use, and it's regulated. You know, if we get into a depression type scenario, the regulators make accommodations, and they're going to let these businesses earn back their decent returns on capital. So you've got, you know, those two regulated businesses within Berkshire that combine generate as much as $9 or $10 billion, 25%, let's call it, of Berkshire's profitability, or is Ironclad immune from a sustained downturn? Again, you know, you'll have a hit to revenues on the railroad, but not so much. The MSR businesses are a whole other story. And kind of back to my client letter, you know, we've been frustrated with some of the disclosures at Berkshire over the last couple, 3 years, a lot of missing information. You know, from back to 2003, I think, you know, Berkshire would, within the chairman's letter, provide a lot of supplemental information about how the key segments of the business were performing. And it was really nice to get just a very simplistic balance sheet and income statement for the consolidated businesses that make up this MSR group. And, you know, that information has gone missing in the last couple of years for a lot of reasons that I shouldn't get into on a podcast. You can read about them in the letter. But, you know, I think, you know, a frustration with Berkshire's management, really for the duration of, you know, owning some of these businesses, and I think they've bought some mediocre businesses in the last decade and a half. You know, if you look at returns on equity of the group, they've declined consistently from 2003. The businesses that make up this group were earning, you know, call it 9.8, 10% back in 2003, 2004, 2005, and they've headed consistently downward. And got to the point where post the Precision Castparts acquisition, which we think was overpaid for a business that we already had some fundamental concerns with. We owned a 1% position in Precision, and we're already struggling with their customers taking various production in-house and away from them. You know, Donegan and his guys rolled up the industry, and I think, you know, who's better off in a transaction, the seller or the buyer? Well, I think the seller in this case was better off. And you saw it in the wake of the deal, because, you know, who would have predicted that the turbine business would be flat on its back, and it was. But the collective group within that MSR group earned 6.5 points on equity in 2016. And we're not in the business as investors of owning businesses that earn 6.5 on equity, if that's a normalized number, even on an unlevered basis. It's no good. And you had a little bit of a bailout the following year with the change in the tax code. You know, if you think about that MSR group, it's very domestic group. And so the cut in corporate taxes from 31% or from 35% to 21% was an immediate 21.5% boost to profitability. So the group then looked like it was earning 8, let's say, on equity again. But, you know, it just unacceptable. And then in the last couple of years, you know, a lot of those businesses have been proving how weak they are. And now you've got, you know, a lot of industry slowing, the auto industry slowing, various pockets of manufacturing slowing again before this virus. And I was really kind of stunned to see 2 years ago when the Berkshire annual comes out. You know, I like to go see how right we were, how roughly right we were, and kind of laying out where each of the segments wound up for year end. And I was stunned to see the revenue number at the MSR group grow by as much as it had exclusively in the fourth quarter of 2018, and figured out pretty quickly, well, they had rolled up the finance and financial products businesses. And you can make the case that by that point, that was such a small group within the whole of Berkshire that maybe it properly should have been rolled up. But then you look at what's happened over the last 2 years, and it should be obvious to anybody that studies Berkshire closely that the highlight business inside of perhaps all of Berkshire Hathaway in the last few years has been Clayton Homes. They've knocked the cover off the ball, absolutely killed it. And so, I mean, they've been growing sales and earnings by 20% a year. And it's very profitable business. And so, you know, by rolling that business inside of the MSR businesses, I think that served to mask this ongoing erosion of profitability. And so the struggle we've had has been management's notion that this is a great group of businesses, this being the MSR group, because they earn, you know, 20, you've read it every year in the chairman's letter, 21, 22, 23% on unleveraged tangible equity. Well, that's inclusive of goodwill. And here's the problem I have with that. If you buy a business at a premium and you put a bunch of goodwill on the balance sheet or other intangibles on the balance sheet, and that business has the opportunity to reinvest capital or take on new capital and grow at those returns or close to those returns, that's terrific. But as most of you all listening know, within the MSR group, these aren't businesses that have use for incremental capital. And most of the profits of most of those businesses, if not, you know, all of the profits of some of those businesses, gets upstream to Omaha. And thus, the only number that matters when you're assessing that group is return on equity, because that includes the goodwill and the premiums that were paid by the business. And if you've driven that number down to 6.5% at a 35% tax rate, then you've got issues. And so you think about this downturn now, and good Lord, I mean, that group was going to do, I don't know, $140+ billion in revenues at $10 billion in profits, let's say. Well, for the year, I have no idea how bad it gets, or, you know, depending on how long the duration of this downturn, but you could shave $5 billion, you know, half of the expected profits off the MSR group for this downturn. Across the rest of Berkshire, you think about where the rest of the profitability comes from. I talked about the rail, the utilities, the MSR. Dividends are about $4.5 billion. Yeah, you're going to see dividend cuts. I mean, there are a lot of companies that should have been out in front of cutting dividends far before now. But again, in any discounting operation, you have to think about the entire tail, not just the current. So, you know, if dividends are whacked down by 10%, let's say, or 20%, you lose $500 million, maybe $1 billion. I wouldn't read a lot into that, because in a lot of those cases, those dividends will snap back over time, unless you get a sustained 20% drop in overall industrial production and manufacturing activity. Then we have a 20% drop in the domestic side of GDP, you know, forgetting about net imports or exports. Then you've got an issue. But I wouldn't read a lot into dividend cuts. Underwriting stands to be fine. I talked about the losses in the insurance operations. GEICO is going to be a huge beneficiary. So, you know, we normalize underwriting profit at 5% of premium. So, you know, maybe $2.5 billion after taxes. You've got the various equity method businesses, Kraft Heinz. All I have to say about Kraft Heinz, whenever I'm asked about it, is how much worse can it get? When you're supposed to get eight or $900 million, maybe $1 billion in profits from the business. You know, we're still going to be manufacturing processed foods, again, with the food industry and its distribution being essential to feeding people when they can't work. And so Kraft probably isn't greatly impacted by the downturn. You've got the other equity method businesses that, you know, collectively are only going to do about $400 or $500 million in profit. The biggest of those is Pilot Flying J. Again, back to keeping the trucking industry running during the downturn. Pilot Flying J has the big truck stops and you know the franchise restaurants within the system. You won't see that drop off. Your volumes will be off. So instead of earning, you know, we've got them earning maybe $300 million on Berkshire's behalf. It'll be off because you won't have the road traffic from the cars stopping in, but the trucks will run and that business will make money. And so, you know, where does the rest of the profitability come from? Well, then you get into the accounting adjustments that we make. And the biggest one that everybody makes are just the look-through earnings for the stock portfolio, which were $10 billion at year-end last year. Pick a number and go through those businesses. You know, a good thing Berkshire doesn't own railroads and banks, right? You know, the earnings are going to be way off for the current year. I mean, who knows what GAAP reported earnings are going to be for Berkshire's collection of businesses, but I guarantee it's not going to be $10 billion for the year. But again, everybody's got to make an assessment for how long and how durable this downturn is, if it's a V, if it's a U, if it's an L. But, you know, if you're discounting the entire tail and we get back to levels of production that we had in 2019 in the not too distant future, you know, by 2021, let's say, then $10 billion in retained earnings that never flows through the income statement at Berkshire is still on the table and viable. And then I've got, for those that read my letter, the optionality premium of the assumption being made that Berkshire will spend a goodly chunk of its cash on things other than T-bills, now earning 2%. So we've always assumed they would put money to work at an average of 7%. We really think they put it to work at 10% plus. The 7% is simply a time value of money mechanism. And we'll find out here on April 15, when Berkshire reports its 13F, as to how active they've been buying shares of stock. I was surprised they didn't buy more in the fourth quarter of 2018. I would lay out a lot of money and bet everybody that they'll have spent a whole bunch of capital buying shares, buying back Berkshire's own shares. And so you'll see some deals, and I don't know if we get to any of these preferred deals like the ones they did in 08 with GE and Goldman Sachs, you know, kind of the 10% preferreds callable at a premium with warrants underneath them. You know, those things wound up yielding 13, 14%. They were beautiful investments. You know, who knows where Berkshire comes into the capital bailout structure when you've got all this federal capital just kind of waiting in the wings to come in. It was interesting. So I think Berkshire, and it's a big, big, big position for us. I think they're in pretty good shape. And, you know, that's really the proper way to think about it. So, you know, when I think about Berkshire, you know, it's got, you know, I said at year end, I thought they had about $42 billion in economic earnings. Well, that includes a couple billion, $3 billion for the optionality of the cash, and everybody can make their own decision about that. You know, so $40 billion won't be $40 billion this year, but again, discounting 2021 and beyond, I think $40 billion is right. So when the stock traded at a market cap a couple days ago for less than $400 billion, I don't recall a time that Berkshire's traded at 10 times what I would call normalized earnings. And it's got a fortress balance sheet, and it's got a lot of businesses there inside that are about as well protected against a downturn as you can have. Made no sense to me that the stock traded at 160. It was weak today. I presume as people are trying to figure out this federal package and trying to figure out how to make money in a hurry, that they'll use things like Berkshire as a source of capital to go chase other things that are more sexy and more high octane. But Berkshire at $400 billion is, in my opinion, as much of a back the truck up as you're ever going to get in a lifetime. And that's not to say this downturn is not going to go way lower and Berkshire can't trade way lower. It didn't give investors a lot of comfort or protection after September of 2008. I remember we as an investor at September 30 of 08, we were about flat for the year. The S&P was down 20. And Berkshire, I think, was pretty much flat for the year. But then from October 1 on until the market low in March of the next year, you know, Berkshire pretty well traded down dollar for dollar with the stock market, and its stock portfolio dropped from something like $80 billion into the 30s. And at a point, 100% of the unrealized gains were gone. And so, you know, I think you were at a point last week where the vast majority of the unrealized gains in the common stock portfolio had evaporated, which is pretty astonishing. But I guess when you've got a lot of airlines and banks during a time like this, not so surprising. I won't get into names, but there are a lot of businesses that we wish they didn't own. I don't think Berkshire's stock portfolio is even remotely as high quality as it should be. And the results in the last, you know, 10 to 20 years show it. But I'll leave Berkshire alone, John. That was way too much, I'm sure, on that, but I tend to go off on tangents when I'm talking about the business that's the kind of the cornerstone of our portfolio. And ask another question if you like.
Yeah, that was terrific. Thank you so much for that in deep dive into where you see Berkshire now and this year. I guess you brought it up earlier, kind of this notion of debt monetization, and we normally don't really go much into the macro stuff, but given just the magnitude of what's happening, I'd like to just get your perspective a little bit more on this. You kind of said we're going to get to debt levels that are quite dangerous. I mean, the question I have is when we were running pretty much record deficits in recent years with a good economy, can anyone credibly hope that that's going to reverse? Are you seeing any even, kind of willingness among politicians of either party to put that as a priority? Aren't the people who think that that balance sheet is going to reverse itself through you know, kind of tightening and taking liquidity out? Aren't they just deluding themselves? And what's really happening is just, as you said, debt monetization and money printing. And then the next question is obviously, what are the implications and what do we need to do?
Well, it's a hard question. And it's a huge problem. You know, for my investing career, starting in the very early 1990s, we watched debt levels grow as a percentage of the economy. And I think, as I said earlier in our talk here, when we got to 250% debt to GDP in 2000, we were concerned. I mean, I think GDP was $10 trillion and you had $25 trillion in total credit market debt. We thought that was a problem. Here we are at 350%. No, I think we've already opened Pandora's box. I mean, I've long hoped, as this whole debt monetization, you know, disallowance of allowing, you know, price to actually find a floor, not allowing the credit markets to do what they should do cyclically. We've deferred a genuine credit restructuring for the last 30 years. We haven't done it. We refuse to do it. The Fed has put a put underneath the market. And, you know, for that, we're now down the path of introducing the tails of the bell curve that you have to, that investors have to think about. And they've always been in the skinny ends of the curves. I mean, the tails are obviously very severe disinflation or deflation on one hand, which is very much what you're having now. I mean, we're trying to deleverage the capital stock. And, you know, virus aside, we've been trying to deleverage the capital stock anyway. The energy patch was going to delever in a massive way this year, as they couldn't, there was no way could they roll the debt that a lot of these independents and smaller companies have taken on as those debts rolled off in the second half of 20 and all of 2021 and 22. But we refused to let it happen. And so, you know, I would say 5% annual deficit in a world of very low inflation is high and problematic, but it's at a slow enough clip that even if we were just going to run $1 trillion, we could have muddled along and debt levels would grow. I mean, hell, Japan has seen their government debt at multiples of where we are, but again, they haven't grown their economy despite taking on all that leverage. And the Bank of Japan backstopping credit assets, even backstopping equities, you know, owning larger swaths of the financial assets in Japan. They haven't introduced any growth. Nominal GDP is no higher than it was 25 years ago, which is an amazing thing. And so you extrapolate kind of that experience, which is an insular economy, kind of internally financed, you know, that the debt inside Japan is inside of Japan. It's not externally owned. In the rest of the industrialized world, all of this debt is externally owned by everybody else. And, you know, parts of it are in the banking system. You know, you look at Dodd-Frank and the notion that the banks are in better shape now than they were in 2007. Yeah, we've got more capital in the banking system, but you've got all these levered credit funds held by private equity and otherwise, levered hedge funds that now have no liquidity. And, you know, the Fed rushing to backstop and provide liquidity in the system is just now has to be done on such a gargantuan scale because we are already at the level of where the Fed's balance sheet was gargantuan and federal debt, which has been increasingly owned by the Federal Reserve and not by private investors. There's just no solution. I mean, again, it's going to be a ballooning. The Fed balance sheet this year stands to double in size. If the math that I went through, being able to lever up kind of $450 billion new capital at 10x, they're going to do that in a hurry. You can't run it off. You saw them try to run it off with the taper in, you know, a couple of years ago. You know, they like I said, they ran the balance sheet down from 4.5 to 3.7, and all of a sudden, good Lord, the economy stopped here and globally. It's just a problem. So I don't know where you get to, but I fear that, you know, assuming I get to live a long lifetime, a full life into my 90s, you know, I'd love to live, you know, as long as Mr. Munger. I think we're going to have to deal with this in our lifetime. And again, there's a reason that in Brazil, in Argentina, wealthy families own land and they own cattle, because every 10, 12, 15 years, they decide to blow up the currency, create hyperinflation, and go back to start. We've never done it. It's never been done on this scale. You know, the global economic system has never had the leverage introduced into it as it has today, and it's done globally. So, the question of can you hide in one currency versus another? I don't think that's even appropriate. I don't know how this plays out. I mean, the best example that I've used with clients in the last couple of weeks is Bayer, which, Bayer today now owns Monsanto and all of their Roundup liabilities. But beyond that, Bayer's a very big industrial business. Well, Bayer was a very big industrial business in Germany between World War I and World War II. And when you had the hyperinflation and the dollar, or the mark rather, went from, I want to say, four to the dollar to 4 trillion. It might have been 2 to 2 trillion, but I think it was 4 to 4 trillion. If you own cash, you lit all your money on fire, you had nothing. If you own bonds, you had nothing. If you own Bayer, you had residual value, because Bayer had industrial assets that manufactured things that people needed regardless of the level of inflation and the level of decline in the purchasing power of the currency. Well, then fast forward from the hyperinflation, and when the Nazis went to war with the world, rolled into Poland, they had commandeered to ramp up for their war effort in advance of launching war, Bayer's industrial assets, and they nationalized the business effectively and used Bayer's assets to make planes and tanks and ships. And of course, Germany lost the war. And for the 2 or 3 years after the war, the Allies, as victors, controlled all of those industrial assets of the countries that lost the war. And ultimately, and I don't remember precisely when, but let's say 2 or 3 years post 1945, were able to go back and reconstruct the shareholder roles to the extent they could. And lo and behold, if you were an original shareholder of Bayer, you salvaged some value. And I don't know how much value you salvaged, but if you think about having gone through a hyperinflation, you think about having lost your assets in a war, both to the country that started the war and then the country that lost the war, and then having had those assets commandeered by the victors, and you still had value, that tells me that tangible assets, but also tangible businesses, businesses that have purchasing power, that sell things people need in any economic environment, whether it's disinflationary, deflationary, or hyperinflationary, can and should be a store of value. Your traditional metrics like price to cash flow and price to earnings and that kind of an environment will not matter. You're simply in a mode of having to preserve wealth. And so I think the game that we're all in of managing money and trying to outperform this and that benchmark is changing, and it's probably already changed, and perhaps it's taken this crisis to do so. But instead of playing the dance of outperforming benchmarks, I think it's going to be very apparent, perhaps with this crisis, perhaps with the next, perhaps it's when we try to run off the $9 or $10 trillion Fed balance sheet a year from now, and you can't do it, that we've gone down the path of monetizing debt. And for that, I take comfort in owning the proper businesses, a lot of the businesses that we own. And we will continue, if this crisis evolves and if debasing currencies, not so much, currencies against each other, but just the purchasing power of currency against tangible assets. If we get on that path, we will continue to make portfolio changes and try to own businesses that can withstand the greatest of economic shocks. And I don't know what else to do. We're all in we live in interesting times, and this is a very, very difficult environment. And, those that have come out and tried to predict that this is the bottom, maybe it is for this round of it, but we've opened Pandora's box, and we're going down the path of having to deal with unsustainable credit levels. And we have a government in place and elected officials in place whose primary responsibility is getting themselves reelected. and not with making the hard decisions. You know, if they'd made the hard decisions, we would have done it 30 years ago and 20 years ago and 10 years ago, and they won't do it. And it takes a crisis perhaps to do it. And, you know, trying to look out where we are in 2 years or in 5 years or 10 years, a lot of it's going to have to do with how we deal with monetizing the debt. But I don't think you can live the rest of your investment life with your head in the sand and pretend like this isn't an issue, because it's been an issue. It's just not been obvious, because you've had this rising tide of all of this fake liquidity lifting all boats. And we're dealing with it now. And again, I hope the ones that are not penalized are the ones who have behaved the best. I think we've behaved well by trying to ferret out the most solid balance sheets that we can own. I'd hate to see, as I said before, the managements of the companies that we own who have done the right thing by being conservative with the capital structure. If those are the ones that are harmed by debt monetization, then we've done something wrong. I happen to think that the over-levered, whether we're not going to restructure them in this iteration, because the Fed's willing to do, or the Fed and the Treasury are willing to do anything they can on the Congress to stave off this particular downturn, but we are going to rationalize that debt in one shape or form. And I don't think the end game is very pretty, but I think it's survivable. And you know, the old adage of the battle for investment survival, it should very much be at the fore of everybody's mind in today's environment. I don't think there's a way to sugarcoat that.
Well, thank you, Chris, so much for that perspective. We'll just have to see how this plays out.
The cheery perspective, right?
Yeah. Well, it's looking, at least at the moment, that you know, the folks who behaved the most prudently are not going to be the ones that get any benefit from what the government is doing, and those who didn't behave prudently, they're the ones getting bailed out, it seems. So that's not sending a great message.
Well, think about this exercise. I know a lot of you guys, a lot of you folks on the line are business owners. You own your RIA shops, or you own whatever. You know, and I don't know what this federal package fully looks like. I know we've kind of quantified the income levels at which individuals can qualify for checks from the IRS. I wish a lot of this were being administered through the unemployment insurance system. But as a business owner, I've got to think about, if the government comes to me and says, Semper Augustus, we will loan you money to keep your workforce intact, to not lay anybody off. And for those of you that understand how RIAs work, you know, we do have fixed cost, and that's our labor cost, and we've got rent. And, you know, we very much benefit as the owner of a money management firm from the operating leverage you get on the upside. You know, our assets under management grow, and, you know, you don't necessarily add incremental cost at the same rate that assets grow. But by the same token, the flip side of that coin is you bear the brunt of the operational decline, and you take markets down a couple, 3 days ago, you know, 32, 33%, in some cases, 40, 45. I think the median stock was down 50%. Well, you know, I don't know where my income is, but, you know, take the conventional, you know, business owner running an RIA, you're going to make a hell of a lot less money when assets are down 20 to 50% or more than you would have. And some will lose money. And so you have the question, do you keep your staff on? Well, we're going to keep our staff on. But if the government comes to me and says, we're going to go to every business with fewer than 500 employees, and we're going to loan you some dollar amount to keep your payroll intact. If we don't take the money and we're monetizing debt that way, then we're the victim of inflation. And I hate to think we're going to be put into that box of having to do the right thing. We've never borrowed a dime of capital on our business. And I'm going to have to make the hard decision, if those are the parameters by which we deal with small business and the government's, you know, good intention of keeping people employed, if they're giving money away on a 1 year or a 2 year loan that as long as you keep your payroll intact, it's a forgivable loan. How can we not think about taking that capital, even though I wouldn't dream of taking it in any other scenario? Because you can't allow yourself to be a victim of inflation when they create it. And I think that's an interesting thought exercise for everybody running businesses and listening in, because it seems like that's where we're headed.
Interesting times, certainly. Well, Chris, I think we'll leave it there. Truly appreciate you taking the time to be with us and share such a fascinating perspective, such a well-researched perspective. Thank you. Appreciate your wisdom.
Well, thanks, John. I'm glad to have done it. It's always good to talk to you, and I think you've done a great job with the MOI platform. I'm a huge fan. I wish I'd gotten involved years ago instead of just 3 or 4 years ago, a couple of years ago, whatever it's been. I will say this is a really crazy couple of weeks, and I did not know this recording was going to be live, and I'm glad it's not on video, because I'm sitting here in, you know, a t-shirt and a golf sweater and running shorts, and I've had, you know, along those same lines, I've had the most unusual conversations with all of these captains of industry and folks that are, you know, in the business world. I can't recall a time that I've heard more dogs barking on telephone calls than I have in the last 2 weeks. It's pretty extraordinary, but you know, everybody seems to be working at home, and it's not just my dog doing the barking.
Absolutely. Well, I've heard a few barks while recording these sessions, and I might be guilty of that myself at times. So I think everybody's tolerance for background noise is a lot higher these days.
If the worst thing we have is some barking dogs and kids in the background, then so be it. I mean, at the end of the day, all that matters in this current iteration, obviously we deal in the world of capital, but you know, it's everybody's health and safety and all of our families and everybody in your family and the MOI community, just broadly speaking. I wish the best to everybody, and I know we'll get through this thing. It's interesting.
Absolutely. Chris, I want to wish you and your family all the very best in this period. Stay safe.
Well, thanks, John. Hope to see you in Zurich in a couple months.
Absolutely. I'll have an update on that in the next couple of weeks. We'll have to see. I mean, it's up in the air, but hopefully we'll have some clarity.
Defer it to the fall, maybe. I wish Berkshire had deferred their annual meeting to the fall and done the formal annual meeting in April or in May, and
right,
you know, have the gathering in October or what have you. But
yeah,
on that front, we'll see everybody in 2021 in Omaha for sure.
Right, right. Okay. Thank you, Chris. Take care. Goodbye for now.
Thanks, John.
Bye-bye.
Take care.